Are you looking to sharpen your command and leadership skills? The 2024 Blue Card Hazard Zone Conference is coming back to the Sharonville Convention Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, September 30th through October 4th. Immerse yourself in 5 days of targeted command education and leadership training at the 2024 Blue Card Hazard Zone Conference. This is your opportunity to recharge your command skills and stay at the forefront of incident command best practices. This year, we've added a certification lab, September 30th through October 2nd. Also added a May Day workshop, October 1st to October 2nd. The general conference is on October 3rd and 4th. The May Day workshop is filling up fast, and our early bird pricing of $415 each for the general conference is a limited time offer. Don't miss out on this opportunity. Register now at HazardZoneBC.com.
This is the B-Shifter Podcast. You've got John Vance, along with Eric Phillips and Grant Light. We are on our final day of FDIC, so we are coming at you from the B-Shifter house, which has been a really nice experience staying over here. So we had a nice time last night, another good dinner in the neighborhood, and early to bed, so we can be fresh to be at the B-Shifter booth and see everybody, all the blue card users, and hang out at FDIC today. So how are you guys doing? How are you enjoying your time?
I'm loving it. It's the convention's been awesome. It seems like there's a lot of people there this year. There's really jumping. And the traffic at the booth has been great.
Yeah. We've met a lot of new people. How about you, Eric?
It's been real good. FDIC 24, a lot of new customers coming by, talking about the system and talking to existing users and seeing the success they've had. It's been great.
One of the things that has been kind of a reoccurring theme here, it seems like, and we've just seen clips because I wasn't in any of these classes in particular because we've been hanging out at the booth. But, you know, there's a quote unquote culture war talking about rescue, and there's this perceived wave of things going on by some in our service that there is anti-search culture, anti-rescue culture. I don't see it. I mean, at least in the departments that I'm involved with, and certainly not with the blue card departments, but it got us talking about some things that have to do with rescue and how we would go about certain rescues and, you know, exactly, the way we would carry that out. To that end, Grant had some questions, and I think it was just some great discussion that we had the other day on all of that. So, Grant, your question and dilemma, I think, is an interesting one because it's one that hasn't come up before, and it specifically has to do with decision-making during a rescue.
Yeah, we did a decision-making class, like a hands-on decision-making class, where we put firemen, you know, fire officers, into different predicaments. And then, you know, they had to make quick decisions that, you know, on what they were going to do. So it was to help them, you know, help build their ability to make decisions, you know, on the fire ground. So it's just like anything else. You practice it and then you get better at it. So one of the things we did was we had the firefighter, the team go search a space. So there was a big buildup. There's a, you know, a big front end piece, you know, to set that up. But in the end, they were supposed to go search a space. And it was pretty far away from where they entered the building. So when they got there, they searched the space and they found a civilian, you know, a dummy, but a civilian on the floor in the room. We set it up so they would find that civilian and then they would start dragging that civilian out as we all would. They called their priority traffic. They did the things they were supposed to do on the radio and all that. And then they worked together to start removing that victim from the space. And what we complicated it by, we had a real human firefighter in full turnout gear, but who was with us would lay down on the floor in the path that they would have to go through to get out of the building. So then they came upon, they had a victim they were pulling out and they came across a fireman who was down. And so that was really the whole setup. So what would they do? Which was our big question. What would they do and what's the right thing to do? I guess is the two things out of that. Over 50% left the fireman there and drug the victim out. So the fireman was unconscious, was in a full firefighting gear, had an SCBA on, but was unconscious. The whole pursuit of this was to see what they would do, like what decision they would make. Some had a huge conversation in the space between the fireman and the officer and his firefighter. Some people tried to drag both people out, but that was not going to work. You know, from all the studies, you know, one guy's not going to get one guy out. And it was a long way to the exit. It wasn't like they were 5 feet from the front door. They tried to move both victims. That didn't work. They would run out of air long before that would, they could make that work. Some people just pushed the fireman off to the side and drug right on past him with the victim. They didn't really do much of anything. Others, like I said, had a big discussion between the two of them. It was obvious that it was a huge moral decision they were trying to make. And it was just interesting to see what the results were. They did call out and say that they found a fireman. Some asked for a rapid intervention team to come in to try to help with the fireman. Some chose the fireman over the victim and they radioed out and said, we're bringing the fireman out. But it was a really good setup, a drill to see what people would do. And we had a huge conversation with them afterwards when they would come out. We would talk to them about, how they made their decision, what they chose, that kind of stuff.
And for the purposes of this conversation, we're not going to give you an answer today because we want you to think about it as an IC, as an officer, as a firefighter, somebody who could be in that position at any time. So let's kind of step through, though, some of the options, because there are options, right? So we're not going to give answers, but we want you to think about some of the options that you have, and then we'll delve into it a little closer. So what are the options?
Well, I mean, the options are take one, take the other, take both, but none of those really work for you. It really came down to one or the other. People that tried to take both, it never was going to work. Then it became down to the choice. And some of the discussions were, afterwards were the officer's perception of like survivability. You know, what's the survivability profile of the victim? And, you know, they were having these things going through their head. That's when they came out, when we asked them, like, why'd you make the decision you made? Right. You know, what was going through your head? What was the thought process? And they got into a big survivability thing. And, you know, we were kind of like, you know, you have no idea what either of those answers are for the victim or for the firefighter. Cause you know, one side says the firefighter was a fully functional human being when he got there, right? He got up out. If there was nighttime, he got up out of bed, he got in the fire truck, he put his fire gear on, he got to the scene, got in the building, and something happened, right? That made him fully unconscious in the building. So 5 minutes ago, he was a fully functional human being. And so what could make that happen? That all of a sudden he's just unconscious. He wasn't out of air. He had air. You couldn't tell if he was breathing or not breathing. He was, because he was a real person, but you know, you couldn't really figure that out in that space. So, you know, his survivability profile would be probably some medical emergency happened, right? And it's very low. And then there was the discussion about the survivability profile of the victim. And you don't know how long they've been there. You know, that some people are like, well, you know, our response time and all that, you know, we might have gotten there within 5 minutes. And it's like, okay, all that's true, but you don't know when the fire started. You know, this fire could have started 3 hours ago and it went ventilation limited. Nobody saw any smoke because it was the middle of the night and the neighbor woke up and was brushing his teeth, looked out his window and saw smoke coming out of the house, right? You don't know if they've been down for 3 hours. There's no way to know. You know, how long that happened or the fire just started and they were really, you know, they went down from that. It's just trying to do the survivability profile was interesting, but there's just really no way to know. It's impossible. So it really comes down to a different decision than just who could survive.
Did any of them talk about their policy on a firefighter with a mayday? Because this is a firefighter with a mayday, and it seems that fire departments typically have a pretty detailed policy on how we're going to deal with a firefighter with a mayday. Was any of that discussed by the participants?
So afterwards, we asked them, we said, you know, what's your department's policy for civilian rescue? And they went, well, I would state it. How many pages is your department's policy for civilian rescue? And they would think for a while. And a lot of them said, like, I don't even know if we really have one. You know, call up priority traffic that we found a victim and then get them out of the building. And I said, yeah, so it's pretty short then. That's probably less than a page. Yeah, that's about right. But all they thought about it, and they didn't really have one. There was no, that they could remember, a written policy. So I said, okay, what's your policy for finding a firefighter down? Oh, well, yeah, that's like 5 pages. It's a mayday and all these things happen, and rapid intervention teams and air, you know, air, getting air into them and doing all these things. And I'm like, okay. So however you look at it, and this was, you know, a countywide, people from a county, all over a county. So it wasn't just one department. It was a lot of departments involved in this. And so we started having the discussions, and we said, you know, that seems to be what most people we've talked to, when we've kind of had this conversation before we actually put it into play, before we made this scenario and put it in, you know, put people through this, was, you know, it seems like I'm talking pretty big here, but like the National Fire Service has made a decision on that. You know, nobody really had a policy for what they do when they find a civilian, but everybody had a huge policy. I mean, pages on what they do if they find a fireman, and all that involved, you know, getting extra people in to help, all the people around them helping, getting air in, all these things to make it seem like, you know, obviously the firefighter was really important. Not saying a civilian is not important. I've searched for civilians. I've pulled people out. I've done all that. But when you call out and say, I found a victim, we don't send somebody in with an airbag. We don't send the rapid intervention team in. They stand there. You know, they stand in the front yard and they wait till the word firefighter is involved, and then they go into play. So it started to become a bigger conversation about, you know, maybe somehow that would be smart to have somebody with an airbag try to go in as fast as they can and meet that crew bringing the victim out, because most of the airbags out there, the RIT bags, however you want to call them, have a face piece in there in case the fireman's face piece is jacked up. You can throw that on the fireman. Well, maybe it would be smart to start doing that for a victim, like that much sooner we're getting them on good air. So it just brought on a lot of more conversation on how we do things.
Let's take a quick break.
Enhance fire ground leadership with our critical thinking and strategic decision making class, designed to strengthen incident command through the functions of command and foster a safer, more effective decision-making process for fire service professionals. The only critical thinking and strategic decision-making class at the Alan V. Brunicini Command Training Center in Phoenix, Arizona is May 22nd and 23rd. Sign up at bshifter.com.
I think you got to look at the system as well there, Grant. It's all about decision making. So, you know, I think somebody said one time, it's all about them until it's about us. And when you start thinking of that quote in the scenario that you're just talking about, there's a lot of decisions that got to be made. And I think it's awesome that you guys are running that drill, getting the officers to think about that before it happens. But when you think about that, you got to have a whole system in place to support the operation that's happening inside of the Ideal H. And when I think of the system that we use, you got to be doing everything right. When something goes wrong is another quote that comes to my, you know, that I'm thinking of right now, is what does that really mean? You've got to have the whole system in place, and you got to be using it on every fire. If you just think that one day it's just going to all work out, it's not going to. So it's awesome that you guys are doing that with your officers, that you have a system that you can exercise that with. And I think that's great. You guys are doing that.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, it got everybody thinking, you know, and you know, bigger than just what happened that moment when, you know, Officer X came upon this, you know, the setup that we had laid out for them, and what they thought about it started everybody thinking about, you know, well, maybe we could do things different in a bigger picture, you know, because we have a whole thing, you know, pages of stuff that we feel is important to make happen when we have a fireman down, but we don't have all that when we find a civilian down. And some of those things that are there, that rapid intervention team or the on deck team that's ready to go in, you know, that was always, you know, first and foremost is always a rapid intervention team, you know, the on deck crew. Maybe that would be, if we find a victim, we get that in operation with that, you know, bringing that air in and meeting them halfway or something. We do it for us. Maybe the thought is we should look more into doing it for them too, you know?
I think it's another discussion to have because, and we certainly have in my organizations before, is if you find a victim, it's going to take a lot of resources to get the victim out. I think oftentimes in our service, we BS ourselves in just a couple of people are going to grab this, you know, it's usually somebody who's over 200 pounds. And a lot of times they're naked, it seems like, at least in my experience. So how are you going to move that person out? And what's going to happen to those crews once they're done doing it? I mean, that's kind of a job of a lifetime type thing, you know, a task of a lifetime. And when you actually do that physical rescue and pull somebody out, you're not ready to go back in and fight fire or even maybe get the rest of the all clear. Plus, that patient's going to need attended to. So, you know, what resources, especially in the ALS world, are going to be dedicated to patient care? So, you know, you start to do all that, that means the next alarm level up. So certainly in our dispatch offices, we say, if you hear a mayday, the best practice is automatically go to that next level. That's why we say when you hear priority traffic and I have found a victim, automatically go to that next level. So you get that help coming because you're going to gas everyone on the scene. And that's just another perspective of this. And something that people don't often think about is the resources that it's actually going to take to get somebody out of the building. And, you know, you talk about the rapid intervention team being there for the firefighters. Well, it's a high risk operation, right? So, you know, getting more companies on deck so we can start to, that's why there's a tactical reserve to begin with. Right. So in case the next radio transmission is either a mayday or priority traffic, whether it's I found a victim or we've got a concealed space fire or whatever it is, we're going to be able to address that with our folks there. What other best practice type thing, I mean, are we leaving out here when it comes to finding a victim and then having a firefighter emergency in the middle of that?
You know, JV, one thing I'd like that you hit on that I think we need to spend a second driving home or at least talking about is, you know, we say expect victims, right? But you said, well, what do we do with them when we bring them out? I think a lot of times if you call them rescues, medic units, ambulances, whatever you call them in your system, I think that's a key point. We do a very good job of bringing them out of the building. We talk about that. We train on that. But we often don't have the system set up to be able to treat that patient and then transport them to the hospital, whatever that looks like within your organization or the system that you work in. But really think about that. What happens on a fire ground? You send a medic unit to the scene. What does the incident commander want to do a lot of times? Well, we want to give them a fire assignment because we want to be the cool guy. And everybody loves going to fires. That's why we do this, right? But really, what happens when you find that victim, you bring them out? I mean, if we're going to be honest with each other today, I think all of us have probably had the experience where we bring a victim out, we send them in the front yard, and there's nobody there to attend them. Now, we can bullshit each other in this conversation all day long. So I'm going to take my gear off, and I'm going to treat the patient. But let's think about it. You're sweaty. You're sweating. Your heart rate's up. You got no medical gear. You're trying to strip your gear off and still attend to the patient. Is that really the best for the patient? So I think that, as we're talking about all this and bringing somebody outside, and I don't care if it's a firefighter or if it's a civilian, we have got to make sure that we have somebody on the outside that's there, prepared, ready to go to accept that patient and actually start treating them. It's great that you can bring them out fast, but what's even better is to get them the medical care that they need to survive after that incident. So make sure that you're doing that. We all want to be the cool IC and the cool officer that your guys get to go to work, but you ride an ambulance or medic unit to the scene, you have a job, and if that's in your system to provide the medical care afterwards, I think it's important.
I think the whole purpose of this conversation is just to give you, the listener, some talking points so you can go back and have an intelligent conversation on rescues, because I think it's so easy to you know, either on social media or to throw out a line about it's about the rescues. Yeah, I mean, it could be and it should be, but let's have an intelligent conversation on what that actually looks like when it does happen, if it does happen, and be prepared for it and challenge people the way that, that Grant's class is. Think about the care for the patient like Eric is talking about. And, you know, whether it's around the kitchen table or in a formal training setting, prepare people for this because, you know, it's eventually going to happen. And you're going to need to make those choices. And oftentimes they're hard choices.
They're really hard choices. In the end, in this thing, over 50% in the end pushed the fireman off to the side because he was in their path and worked to drag the victim out of the building. They left him behind. So that was interesting. You know, like I said, there's everybody's got in their brain, they got what the right answer is. You guys got to try to figure out what it is for you. I know what my thought process was for the right answer, on which of those, you know, in the end, it came down to you had enough manpower to get one or the other out of the building. It was not going to work trying to get both out because by the time they got there, it was set up. So by the time they got there, they were in a position where they were going to be running out of air soon. So they couldn't take all day to do it. So, but yeah, over 50% left the fireman behind and took the victim out.
I think that was a great discussion. I think it's something that we do encourage you to have at your department within your training organization. Thanks so much, guys, for talking about this today. Hey, you have time for a timeless tactical truth?
Let's do it.
All right. Eric does.
Timeless tactical truth from Alan Brunicini. This one says, planning for the future simply may not work. Planning for change is probably the best shot we have. Again, the timeless tactical truth. Planning for the future simply may not work. Planning for change is probably the best shot we have. You know, Bruno always used to say we have to be willing to change and change is inevitable. We're going through a lot of changes right now in the fire service in general, not only with fire behaviors, everything is changing. What's your thoughts on that truth?
Firefighters hate two things, the way it is, but don't change it. So I think change in the fire service, we got to do it. We call ourselves professionals. We say we're a professional organization. What does that really mean to us? Well, we got to look at the science, the facts, the data, and we got to adapt to that. There's no profession that I know of that is doing business the same way today that they did 5, 10, 15 years ago. But for some reason in the fire service, we want to hold on to some of those things and not change, even though we have the, you know, the science and the data, the line of duty death reports. We can't be afraid to change. And I think that's something that we ride a wave. We're good for a second for change, and then we buck it. And why that is that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Eric says. You know, I always jokingly, you know, jokingly say, you know, what in your life do you do the same way you did 30 years ago, right? Other than maybe shower and a few other things, you probably do just about everything you do different. You know, whether it's your phone, iPhone that you carry with you 24/7, when before it was just a thing on the wall that had a cord to it. And yeah, you'd get to it when you got to it. And if somebody called you, you were home, you got it, you didn't, whatever. I mean, there was 30 years ago, there weren't even answering machines yet. So there's nothing you do today that you did 30 years ago. But for some reason we'll sit around and talk about, you know, this guy did this 30 years ago and, you know, we're trying to do the same thing. And it's like, it's all changed. Come to FDIC. You want to see change? Come to FDIC. And there are, I don't know how many vendors there are. I heard there was 1,000. I don't know if that's true. From little guys who got one idea and, you know, a fireman just out there got an idea and he put it together and he's hoping Shark Tank picks him up and he makes $1 million. But there, everything there is change. I mean, it's unbelievable to walk around. All these beautiful new fire trucks are nothing like fire trucks 30 years ago. All the gear stuff, all the equipment, all the tools, all, everything, nozzles, everything has changed. It's incredible. We have got to change with it. Every business in America has changed. Like Eric said, it's all changing, and we can't. I mean, I tradition's cool, right? And I'm all about the fire tradition, but. But change is also part of tradition too. Like everything changes.
I think it's also important to think about the fire environment has changed. And I don't think anyone argues that fact that the fire environment has changed over the years. Well, that means that the other side of the equation has to change as well. We can't be doing things the way we did because the fire environment's not even the same. And that doesn't mean that anyone did it wrong before us, but for that time or that era, it was the best that they knew. And I think we need to acknowledge that and not push that aside. Acknowledge it, but let's move on to what we're facing today. And it's not going to be the same in 5 years from now. And I think we all know that. Right. So in 5 years from now, what we're doing today probably isn't going to be best practice. It's going to be something different. We can't be afraid to change and keep doing the best that we can do for everybody involved.
Before we go, I would be remiss, Eric, since you're on today. What are you going to be teaching at the Hazard Zone Conference in October of 2024? We have registration going on right now. You can get to that in the show notes. You're going to be there doing some presentations. We talked on the last podcast on what Grant's doing, but let us know what you're going to be doing at the conference.
Hazard Zone this year, we're going to be in Cincinnati. Hope everybody's able to make it out. We're going to be rolling out the after action review. We talked about it last year. We did a little class on it last year, kind of previewing everything. But on the new platform, B-Shifter has been working on, it's going to allow us to officially roll out the after action. And really, truly, how do you measure success on the fire ground? How does your department do that? We're going to dive into that and give you some tools and a program that you'll be able to evaluate your department and the incident command system. How do you communicate? And again, it all comes down to changing behavior on the fire ground to make better decisions. So come out and see us. So look forward to rolling out the program. It's going to be sweet, JV. We're going to have audio. We're going to have video that you can put into it. Let's do it.
Yeah. You know, just oddly enough, Eric and I were walking around the convention yesterday, the floor with all the displays, and we were talking to folks, and just one random conversation, someone asked us, hey, when is Blue Card going to roll out a standard after action review program? And we're like, hey, as a matter of fact, here's the guy, and he's got one coming. So I'm looking forward to seeing that in October in Cincinnati at the Hazard Zone Conference. It's going to be a game changer for especially for the Blue Card users who are going to have access to it. All right. Hey, thanks so much for joining us on this B-Shifter podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, tell your friends. Until next time, thank you so much for listening to B-Shifter.